Welcome, everybody, to the new Breaking Kayfabe. I'm your host, Jeff Bowden. With me is my co-host, Barry, back with the cable and the phone, Rose. Bear, how's it going?
Oh, it's going great. I'm on about 2 hours of sleep over the last 2.5 days. My back hurts. I haven't showered. But I'm in a terrific mood. Despite all that, I'm in a terrific mood. I'm super excited about the show today. We had such a great show last week when we had Roop on with us as a guest. And this week, we're kind of back to our roots. We're going to be talking about matches again. We've got a top five. I know we're going to touch on one of my favorite subjects, which is a blaxploitation movie. And then I think you've got a couple of surprises for me because you told me you might be poking the bear, but you weren't going to tell me what you were going to be poking other than the bear. So I'm actually pretty excited about this today.
I love a good surprise. By the way, I would also like to mention before I continue the intro, as I posted on the Facebook page, Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry, facebook.com/ Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry, that last week's episode, according to the great Brian Last, our highest rated show ever. We are incredibly happy, and we thank everyone that listens so much. But to continue on this show, we're not just going to break kayfabe on the wrestling business. We'll break kayfabe on sports, movies, television, music, pop culture. This is Brian's favorite part. We're going to break kayfabe on life. And on today's show, we're going to discuss two of my top 100 matches, including the match that really got me hooked on Japanese wrestling. All that, plus we're going to talk about one of Barry's all-time favorite movies. And by the way, folks, did you know that besides Patrick Swayze and Jumbo Tsuruta, Barry Rose has another crush? Barry, why don't you tell them who your celebrity crush is? Dare I say your celebrity hall pass?
Yeah, so this one's a female, which makes things a little bit better.
That's always good to know.
Exactly. I think
you're a multitasker.
Yeah, exactly. So this one is the lovely and talented Pam Grier. I've had a crush on Pam Grier since I think my parents took me to a drive-in in the early 70s where I saw the movie that we're going to discuss today, and I think it was the first time I ever saw a pair of breasts on screen. And so I do have a crush on Pam. It's we're going to really dig deep. We're going to break kayfabe, and we're going to really discuss it today when we discuss what I think is arguably maybe her best movie. She's got two or three there that are right at the top, but the one we're going to talk about, it's going to be good.
I'm glad to know that Mr. and Mrs. Rose brought young Barry along right by at an early age, taking her to see the breast on the big screen. And so that's very nice of them. All this plus, Barry and I are going to be discussing our top five most underrated promo guys in the history of wrestling. That's right. No movies or television other than coffee this week. We're going to be keeping it in the wrestling genre as we discuss who we think are our top five most underrated promo guys. So, Barry, you about ready to go? Oh, wait a minute. I'll stop before we do. Barry, I just want to give you a quick shout out. I know you've been dealing with some weather up there. As we also posted on the Facebook page, you know, Barry and his crew went out to San Diego, where I'm guessing the weather is a lot better than it is in the Northeast right now. And Barry, why don't you tell them a little about the food drive you did? And you did some really good things out there. Real quick, tell them about that.
Yeah, we did. So I work for a company called Open Table, and I've been with them for over 6 years. And Open Table, if you've ever used the product, it's essentially electronic marketing for restaurants. It's where you can make a reservation for a restaurant electronically. You can get onto opentable.com. You can a lot of times get onto a restaurant's website, and you can just make a reservation. They receive that information. So I love working for Open Table, and I've gone to, this was my 7th yearly conference, and we always tend to do them somewhere out in California, near Vegas. And a lot of it is we learn about new products, we learn about new things happening in the industry, etc. This was the first time that we did a true team building experience. And what we did was, there's a company called Rise Against Hunger, and it's essentially, it is completely dedicated to feeding children. There's some sort of stat that, you know, there's like 50 or 60% of the children worldwide, they go hungry every night and they don't get enough food. So we got, I think there was like 550 of us, and we went in shifts, essentially, you know, maybe 175 per, and we were bagging food, weighing it out, and then sealing it, putting it in into boxes where the boxes just had to be shipped. So at the end of the day, 550 people, something like that, essentially over a little less than 3.5 hours, we bagged over 51,000 bags of food. So for me, I walked out of there, and again, we've done so many of these conferences, and a lot of them, as anybody who's in business will tell you, you're sitting in a chair listening to people speak for 2 or 3 hours. It's not really a lot of fun. This was a lot of fun, but I think everybody who left the room that day really had this sense of pride, like we really accomplished something and we did something good. So I got to admit, I was super, super proud to be working for Open Table when I left that room. And I actually, to me, the first thing I did was I went up to the guy in charge of this company. We had like the CEO there, which, you know, we had the head guy there. And I shook his hand and I said, I got to tell you, after 7 years, this is the best thing that any of the conferences have ever offered. And I would like to see if we can bring this to Philadelphia at some point. So I got his contact info. We got mine, and I'm going to see what I can do about bringing it here. But it's such a worthwhile cause, and it doesn't require, you know, you giving money or anything like that. You just give up your time. And they made it so much fun. That was the other cool thing. The group that I was with, people I've known for 5-6 years, we were just having a blast. The music's blaring. I'm listening to 80s Duran Duran. We're high-fiving each other, and we're bagging and sealing up food. So super, super cool. I appreciate the love and the shout-out. Jeff, you posted it in the group, and some people were really so kind in their comments. And, you know, look, I should get zero credit for this. That has nothing to do with it. But the fact that there are these companies that are out there that are truly dedicated to helping people, which is rare now, they should be receiving all the credit for sure.
Yeah, and we got a lot of positive response on the Facebook page. However, I'm going to say at this point, I am pretty much sure now that you've admitted that someone's going to go on that particular post and mention that they hate you for listening to Duran Duran, because that's the nature of the beast. You know, everyone's got a favorite band or group, and someone's going to completely dismiss Duran Duran as being 80s trash. So now that being said, let's get back to the 80s. We're going to go to December 13th, 1982. We are at the finals of the All Japan Tag Team Tournament. We are talking Stan Hansen and Bruiser Brody against Dory and Terry Funk. Barry, tell me what you thought of this match.
Absolutely. So before I even go further, at the beginning of the show, you mentioned that this was this the match that brought you into watching Japanese wrestling?
It was not, Mr. Spoiler Alert.
Well, you're the one that said it.
You can't. No, I know, but it's the second match we're going to talk about.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to say, because, and I think with going off of what you said earlier, and look, the other match is a great match as well, but to that end, if I had never seen Japanese wrestling and somebody showed me this match, I would have been hooked. That's so in my head, I'm going, I bet this is the match, because you've got the Funk Brothers against Hansen and Brody. So you've got really, you know, especially when it comes to Terry Funk and Brody, you've got two guys that the internet and hardcore fans have just loved. Smart fans, we've loved these guys forever. Hansen and Dory are also right there, and all four of these guys are legends. This is such a good match. And the cool thing about this was, you and I actually delayed this match by a couple of weeks. And I think part of that was because we were able to get Bob on last week. So I watched this match over 2 weeks ago. And I watched this match just a few days ago. I was out in San Diego and I came in, and, it was probably, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning. So it was like 4 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. And I was like, yeah, I'll put something on. And I actually watched the match again. And I got to admit, this is one of the great matches really of all times. All four of these guys were just really at the best that they could be. Brody and Hansen, you know, and I'm such a Brody fan. You know, for me, it's Brody and Terry were the two guys that I'm just really, but, you know, Brody and Hansen did a lot of selling for the Funks, and I don't think I've ever seen two, you know, Brody and Hansen ever sell the way that they sold for the Funk Brothers. And no doubt, you know, in reading books and et cetera, there's a lot of respect for Terry and Dory and bringing Brody and Hanson into the game. So, and in watching this too, and, you know, and I know you and I even talked about this a little bit, but Dory and Terry look to be working a lot stiffer and tighter than we're used to in U.S. rings. And especially Dory, some of those punches and forearms, he's laying them in. I mean, this is not the typical, you know, U.S. territory type of punch. These guys are really laying them in. And one of the big surprises was watching Hanson's drop kick on Terry. You know, I don't remember how many times I've ever seen Hanson throw a drop kick, but he doesn't just throw a drop kick. He throws a good drop kick, which to me, I was kind of like really astounded. Like, wait a minute, did Hanson? I went back and I watched it again. Terry gets busted open. Terry is, he's bleeding. And for a minute there, he looks like he's bleeding out of the side of his head. And I went back to watch it to go, did I miss something? Is this hard way? And it's not. But at the same time, it looks legitimate because he's kind of bleeding from the side. Dory gets busted up later in the match. Terry always the character, and I thought this was so cool. Terry takes a bump outside the ring, and he's covered in all the streamers, and he's like a mummy, just wrapped up in all these really colorful streamers, and he's trying to fight his way out of it, and, you know, just so cool. But a great spot, too, where Brody is holding Dory, and Hanson delivers the lariat, and it's so powerful that Dory goes down, the ref goes down, and Brody goes down. Brody, like, goes into the ropes. So the ref is down, and then the second referee, who is six-time NWA World Heavyweight Champion Lou Thesz, actually comes into the ring. And then Brody and Hanson, ever the wild men, attack Lou Thesz. Thesz immediately DQs them. And then as the Funks are being awarded the trophies, which I just thought was great, Hanson, also a complete psychopath, comes back in the ring and gets into this barn burner of a brawl with, you know, Jumbo Sheruda, man. There it is. Every episode I'm going to say it. And in Sheruda and Hanson are pounding each other, and you can listen to these forearms and punches. They're like clubs, and you can actually hear the skin on skin when these guys are hitting each other. So I just thought this was so great. But I did pull up a couple of notes off of the internet. One was Stan Hansen, and Hansen said, I never hit anyone in the ring harder than I hit Terry Funk, and I'm sure he'd say the same about me. And I think we can say that in this match, because I don't think I ever saw these guys really go at it like that. And the Funks were really over with the fans. I did read a note where it said the gusto from their heydays in the late 70s was starting to fade. And I don't know if I agree with that, but lots of fans felt that they were lied to when Terry announced his retirement, only to make the first of numerous returns. But over in Japan, where many deals were solely on handshakes with no contracts, it's taken seriously when someone says something like that. That's why Terry started working for other Japanese promotions in the 90s. So what's your take on that? Because when I pulled up that really resonated with me to the point that, you know, I know Terry is still, Dory still goes over. They're still considered gods over there. But there is truth that Terry did start working for, quote unquote, the garbage promotions, FMW, et cetera, in the 90s. So what do you think about that?
Well, this was actually before Terry had left, because Terry did his retirement match in August of 83. This was December of 82. So, and I think, I'm not sure, but I'm thinking maybe that had something to do with the fact that he thought he was going to get a bigger break in movies than actually happened. And that might've been while he started the whole retirement, stuff. But, you know, one of the notes that I made, first of all, when they come into the ring, the Funks are just incredibly over with the Japanese crowd. I see a sign that says, "Welcome to Japan. You're still number one." You know, and to me, as I watched this, you know, I'd heard stories from Terry himself about the drives they used to go on in Amarillo, in the Amarillo territory. They'd go from one town to another. And at one point they had, I think it was Jumbo, when Jumbo was still a younger guy, like maybe mid-70s, had gone over to Amarillo to work, and they used to drive, dare I say, extremely fast between towns. And Terry was a bit of a wild man, and Terry liked to shoot off guns in the air. And he told this story about Jumbo being in the backseat of his car as he cruised right through a kind of a one-stop town where the sheriff was trying to get Terry in a speed trap, and Terry started shooting his guns in the air, and Jumbo was in the back seat laughing, saying, "Oh, just like like John Wayne, just like cowboy western." And so I think that the Japanese fans at a certain point in time, the reason they love the funk so much is they really associated the funks with being cowboys and that whole wild western motif and the lifestyle that they had been trained to believe, from movies. And they really thought that the funks were the living embodiment of the cowboy hero. It was interesting to see Lou Thesz, as you mentioned, as the second referee, along with Joe Higuchi. The crowd is just white hot. And I made a notation about how Brody was selling, Terry's punches. Brody, notorious as a guy that does not sell, moves unless he's got an inordinate amount of respect for the person. And obviously he's got a lot of respect for both of the brothers. But he was giving Terry all kind of, room when he would throw the punch and he would sell it like he'd really been hit. And it was extremely rare. And it's nice to see that. The brawl goes into the stand. There's a great false finish. And here, the fact that it was the finals of the tournament, that really made it interesting. You made a notation about this. The amount of color that Terry gets, it's not terribly surprising. It's kind of a regular feature of Terry. But Dory getting that much color really kind of surprised me, because Dory, while he would have, on occasion get color, this was definitely not the amount of color that Dory was known to, to get at all. This was very, very shocking to me, even that, to see a guy like Dory, who's, he was always the brothers, according to Gordon Sully, were always fire and ice, and Terry was the fire, and, Dory was the ice, the cold blooded one. And to see him really get in a brawl like this was really pretty interesting. I know a lot of people have kind of been dismissive of Dory later in his career and later in this decade, but at this point he was still, he was really on fire. And this was, interesting to see Thesz get involved in the finish. Match went 12 minutes and 30 seconds. The young boys around the ring are just getting tossed around to and fro. As they're doing the trophy presentation, as you said, Hansen comes in, knocks over the trophies. I thought that was kind of interesting. And I also noticed, I don't know if you caught this, Barry, we had a Jim Barnett sighting at ringside. I thought that was kind of interesting. There must have been 25 photographers around the ring. This is really treated as a sporting event. This is not like, a Bill Apter and George Napolitano at ringside. 25 photographers, shooting not only the match, during, but afterwards, the ceremony presentation. And that's just crazy to see how over this tournament was at this time.
Yeah, it's such a spectacle, and I know that we've used that word previously when it comes to matches, but this match is larger than life, and just really from beginning to end. And I remember reading Stan Hansen's book, which was an excellent read, by the way, and I remember the respect that he had for the Funk Brothers, and Terry was the guy that really brought him into professional wrestling. And it's interesting. I started reading, and you and I talked about this probably 2 years ago, but I started reading Bob Backlund's book yesterday, because literally I had no power. I had nothing else to do. I had Backlund's book and I'd never read it. And it's an excellent book so far. But he mentions that Terry's the first guy that actually brought him along, that Terry took him from the tri-states McGurk area, where he was making no money, no respect whatsoever, and actually saw something in him and brought him to the Amarillo territory, and then actually gave Bob the Western States title with a victory over Terry. Like, Terry actually made this decision, and Bob had only been wrestling professionally for just a couple of months. So, the Terry Funk stories to me are just kind of legendary when you start to hear them. And he's done so much for so many people. To me, spectacular.
Yeah, what a compliment to Bob Backlund. I had no power and nothing to do, so I started reading Bob Backlund's book, which, by the way,
it didn't come out right. It didn't come out right. That's not what
I have read that book, and it's one of the better wrestling books you'll ever read, because Bob has an incredible memory. He literally breaks down every single guy, like when he gets to his WWF run, he breaks down every single challenger, who he thought good challengers were, the guys that he did not like, and there were a few of those, and he doesn't pull any punches in discussing that. So here we go, Barry. It's time to poke the bear. Bob Backlund, let's say 81-ish. We discussed last week that Bob Backlund and Steve Kern, do you think Kern would have been a better choice for Vince McMahon Sr. So Bob Backlund has the belt. He's got it for about 3 years. Let's be candid. He was doing pretty well. He was pretty popular. And then at some point, the fans kind of turned on Bob Backlund. Vince Sr. stayed with him. It's pretty much agreed a little too long. So I'm going to give you three names, Barry. Which one of these three guys should have taken the belt from Bob Backlund? Are we going Don Morocco, Greg Valentine, or do you wait until 1982 and go Jimmy Snuka? Or is there somebody else?
I would say I'm going to go. That's a tough one. So I think you're poking the bear. I have zero prep. So in my head, I'm doing all these rationalizations kind of on the fly. I'm going to go with Morocco because Morocco in 81 was still maybe the best heel in the business. And if he wasn't the best heel, he was certainly top five. By 83, 84 or so, 85, he had gained weight. He was sluggish. He's eating sandwiches in the ring. It's his gimmick, and I get it. But at the same time, this guy was a monster in 81. So I would say Morocco, possibly Snuka. I never thought Snuka was great as a heel. I certainly thought he was very good, but I didn't think he was completely off the charts. At the same time, I think the future was really in Jimmy Snuka being a babyface. And Greg Valentine, I'm going to say this right now. I've always felt Greg Valentine was a little bit overrated in professional wrestling. So that's certainly going to get me a little bit of hate mail this week, which is absolutely fine. I'm going to throw another name out there, and I don't know if this guy was deserved to hold that title, but and I've said this in at least in the CWF Archives Facebook group many times and even in other places, but Joe LeDuc was tailor-made to be a challenger for Backlund. I'm talking the maniacal, you know, cutting your arm with an axe, blood oat Joe LeDuc. And that guy, to me, in the Northeast, doing those kind of promos with the bug eyes, he would have drawn super, super money. I mean, Sweet Hansen was a challenger for Backlund. And I'm not knocking Sweet, but, you know, let's be honest. He was definitely past his prime, maybe 10 or 20 years past his prime when he was getting these title shots. So to that end, I always thought LeDuc in the Northeast would have drawn money. To your point, I'm going to go with Morocco because I do feel that 79 to 82 period, probably the best heel in the United States.
Yeah, that's the guy that I would have picked too. Morocco was on an unbelievable roll as a heel, even with eating the sandwich in the ring. I completely agree, and I brought it up before. I think we've discussed it, that Joe LeDuc is a guy they completely missed a boat of, because if you think about it, you had, as Vince Jr. liked to call him, Big Raw-Boned Sweet Hansen. But then you had guys like Mosca going up there. You had Blackjack, who was past his prime by that point. Blackjack was great, late 70s, maybe into 80, but then he really started kind of falling down. Really, you know, his ability really started taking a hit. And, you know, by the time I think he came in, and I think he had a run with Backlund, I want to say like 81, 82-ish, but he was well past his prime. So all things considered, Joe LeDuc definitely would have, you know, I think he would have really made some money with Bob Backlund. There's no question about that. Okay, so we're going to go to our second match. We're talking August 2nd, 1984. This is the match that really grabbed me by the throat and said, start watching Japanese wrestling. We are talking our friend from, was it last week or the week before? Kuniaki Kobayashi taking on the Cobra, George Takano, the guy that had the unfortunate task of trying to replace Satoru Sayama as the mask guy in New Japan. Satoru Sayama, of course, was Tiger Mask. George Takano was the Cobra. Barry, tell us what you thought about this match.
Yeah, so this is another great match too, and we've talked about Kobayashi a couple of times right now, and he really was tremendous. When I look at the Cobra, he's a very spectacular wrestler, but and you mentioned Tiger Mask, this guy's got Mil Mascaris written all over him. It's the same style mask. He's got a similar physique. He's not sucking in the gut. He doesn't have a gut, but he wears the same type of trunks, and it's got those knee patches that Mascaris had always had. So to me, it's like they're trying to build this Japanese version of Mascaris. This is a great match. And what was cool about this was watching these guys fight through the crowds together. get to the ring. And I know that we've seen that, you know, especially with Brody, and he would swing the chain, and you would hear the Immigrant Song by Led Zeppelin. But, you know, just watching these guys trying to get to the crowd, especially Kobayashi, and he looks like he's taking somebody out. You know, he's turning around, he's shooting these daggers at people. I would say, of all the matches that we've discussed, this has one of the best opening sequences ever that I've ever seen. Cobra enters the ring. He does the flip off the top rope, and literally midair, he's met with this spinning back kick to the face, and he flies out of the ring. And I'm watching it, and immediately I'm like, holy shit. And I stop it, I rewind it, whatever you call it on YouTube, I scroll backwards, and I watched it again, and I probably watched it three times, because this flip off the top rope met with the spinning back kick is spectacular. Kobayashi then does a dive through the middle ropes on Cobra. After this, they which I thought was amazing. So after that, they go through the traditional Japanese pre-match ritual of handing the wrestlers flowers. So Cobra just got the shit kicked out of him. They've had this whole sequence already where they were beating each other up or whatever, but they still get back in the ring and they still get the flowers handed to them. Cobra does this handspring flip over the top rope, and he looks like he's almost going to kill himself, because he does this flip, and I don't know if Kobayashi wasn't in the right spot. I just think that Cobra didn't get enough, you know, to get over the top rope. So he gets over the top rope, and he almost just collapses right on the floor. To me, this match becomes total bedlam. They're battling outside the ring. They're hitting each other with signs. What was the finish of the match? Was it a no contest? You know, I'm almost unsure of how the match even ended, but I got to admit, this was about as exciting a match as you're ever going to see. And I did some research on Kobayashi, which I never really did before. He had two surgeries for colorectal cancer in 92 and 93. In 99, he had surgery to combat liver cancer, leaving him with this really large scar under his chest. This pretty much ended his career. But in April 2000, he wrestled his final match ever, losing to Liger. I had no idea, but apparently he's still involved in Puro. He is the caretaker of the New Japan Dojo. You and I have talked about it. I think Kobayashi is one of those guys that kind of missed the cutoff point of the next generation, your Ricky Choshus, your Ligers, et cetera. And when they kind of took it in the mid to late 80s is when his career was kind of winding down. So he was kind of that previous generation, but he's really spectacular. And you brought up, you know, his traps, I think it was last week when you were mentioning that. You know, his physique for a guy in Japan at this stage too is really something to see. It doesn't appear to be a guy that's on the juice or doing anything, just a guy that's really hardcore into shape. So I could see where this would be the match that would bring somebody to Japanese wrestling.
You know, he was kind of a really interesting guy in that he did not look like everybody else. You know, he had the long pants that he wore. I mentioned it previously. He threw probably the best leg lariat that I've ever seen, even till today. I mean, you know, all the great, you know, guys that do these moves, like Kota Ibushi, those kind of guys. But his leg lariat in this match is just absolutely amazing. And, you know, I remember, and I said it an episode or two ago, that Brian Pillman would throw a leg lariat, but he would keep his leg completely stiff. And Kobayashi's literally like wraps itself around the guy's neck as he throws the leg lariat. It's just an amazing move. Yeah. So this match, just absolute chaos starts out at the beginning, Kobayashi attacks and throws it out in the opening spot. I remember seeing this we're talking almost 35 years ago now. But when I saw this, I was like, holy shit, what is this? You know, the throw into the gate, you know, everything's flying, you know, and then, you know, you've seen the spot, how many times have we seen the spot where the heel in the match is going after the mask of the baby face and trying, and the ref scolds him, and he'll get like a couple strands out of the, off the mask, and the mask wrestler will continue to wrestle. Well, this one, he takes it off and like throws it to the crowd, and, you know, they have to bring in like a second mask while they keep him under cover of a towel. And it was almost like it gave me the feel like, maybe he wasn't supposed to do that. And he kind of, you know, went off. I mean, I'm sure that's not what it was, but it had the feel that that's what it was, you know? And it's just
I agree.
Crazy wild finish where, you know, all these guys are getting in, trying to separate him as he's, you know, after he's taken the mask off. Now I will mention, here's what's interesting about this match. And it's in a lot of ways, it's not unlike a match from today where you have some unbelievable spots, but then you got a couple blown spots too, where you can see somebody messed up and somebody wasn't where they were supposed to be. You made a reference to that. So, you know, this is not a perfect match. I mean, there are obvious points where you go, yeah, that guy missed that one. But then it's, you know, balanced with these moves that just make you go, oh my God, that is just crazy. And, you know, it definitely, as I said, reached out, grabbed you by the throat and said, you know, hey, check out Japanese wrestling, Jeff Bowdern, and see what you think of this, mister. So now time for Poke the Bear part two. Barry, I'm going to stay in the United States. We're not going to go into Mexico because we know there are innumerous numbers of luchadors that wear masks. In the United States, Barry, tell me who your favorite mask wrestler was of all time.
Actually, so it's an easy one. It's a tie. Are ties allowed?
It's an easy one. It's a tie. That's funny.
Well, because there really are two guys, and these were two guys that actually teamed up in Florida in the early 80s and around 1981, but it is the original assassin, Jody Hamilton, and the spoiler, Don Jardine. So these are my two favorite masked guys, and people always bring up the other name. You know, the masked superstar seems to be a name right at the top, and Mr. Wrestling too. You know, for me, the assassin, and a lot of it is it's going to be the people that you grew up watching. So I grew up watching the assassin on a weekly basis. I grew up watching the spoiler, and these two guys were complete packages. They were fantastic in the ring. They really were tremendous in the ring. They were also tremendous interviews, and it was kind of the thing where, you know, in later years, like Mil Mascaris, I'm not really a big fan of Mil Mascaris, and a lot of people aren't, so I get that. But at the same time, there was such a hype and such a buildup on Mascaris, and then the first time I saw him, I was like, and that was it? You know, wait a minute, you know, did something happen here? That was it. So for me, it is, I know it's almost a cop-out when I say two, and if you're going to push me, I am going to say the assassin, but those are the two guys. How about you?
Well, I would definitely agree with you with Jody Hamilton as the Mask Assassin. He was at the very first match. I've mentioned it many times that I've ever attended as a kid. Totally grabbed me and hooked me. Bill Eadie as the Mask Superstar. I'll throw another guy out there that was around right when I was first becoming a wrestling fan, and that's Tim Woods, who was the original Mr. Wrestling. I was a big fan of Tim Woods, too. So one of those three guys, I would say. I'd probably go Jody Hamilton just because he was the guy at the very, very beginning. Superstar was later, you know, later on, you know, into the 80s was the guy that I really liked. I'll tell you another guy that nobody mentions that was a really, really terrific worker and a great talent that we lost way too young, and that was Scott Irwin as the Super Destroyer in Georgia. He was tremendous. Yeah, he was really good. So,
absolutely.
Doesn't get
enough, you actually pointed that out.
Yeah, does not get enough credit either. So, So now that we're done with the two matches, Barry, I tell you what we're going to do. We are going to go to the Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdern and Barry Facebook page. Since we had a slight delay, only a slight delay in our recording today, I put a little message up on the board and said, I will take the best three questions. So we'll do a little talking point here, Barry. So the first question goes from Mike Fahey. How you doing, Mike? Mike says, if someone tried to run an old school wrestling promotion today, what would be the bigger problem? One, the difficulty in getting current fans to suspend disbelief, or two, finding enough guys who knew how to work that style. So what do you think the answer to that one would be, Barry?
Jeez, how do you answer that question, right? So difficulty in getting current fans to suspend disbelief. Yes, absolutely. That's going to be huge. Finding enough guys to work that style anymore, I think it's going to be number one. And I think partly is if you're going to try to run a true old school promotion, you would have to get some sort of time machine to go back where kayfabe isn't going to be broken. So, you know, I think part of it is you can teach people how to work an old school style. I believe it's done. I know that the great Malenko, and that it was passed down through his sons and Frankie Reyes, were actually teaching an old school style. They weren't doing all these crazy flips and all of this other stuff. They were working the way that guys worked in the 70s. However, fans at this point are not of the same mindset that they were 30 and 40 years ago. So, you know, when you say that, we can never run an old school promotion. It's never going to happen exactly the same way that you remember from 30 and 40 years ago. However, there are certain promotions which are doing a better job. At the end of the day, it's up to the fans. Are the fans going to be the fans who put themselves over? And when I talk about that, when fans putting themselves over instead of putting the action in the ring, or are they going to be fans that are going to be putting over the product that they're seeing? So that, in my opinion, it's number one. It's an excellent question, by the way, Mike Fahey. Yeah, great job, man.
Good job. Our next question comes from John Doe, because from a guy that we mention pretty much every week, and we're not going to give him that much credit this week, so I'm not going to say his real name, but if you read the message, you'll see and figure out who it is. John Doe says, what was the best card you ever saw live, and what was the worst?
John Doe.
John Doe. By God, you're not getting credit.
Good God. And that's why I just pulled up the Facebook page to see who John Doe was, and look who it is. It's our old friend John Doe. So I love it. I'm going to let you take that one. I'm going to think on that one for a second. Go, sir. You're up.
Obviously, my best card, I mentioned it before, was December 1987, the Japanese women's card at Corican Hall that I went to with the 10-woman tag that went like, I don't know, 60 minutes or 50 minutes, something like that, which is, by the way, a match that we're going to be discussing in the coming weeks here, because that was one of my top 100 also. Best card I ever saw in the United States, I'm going to go Great American Bash 1989 in Baltimore, July 1989, the Funk Flair brawl where Flair ends up looking like a Christmas tree. Worst card, I've been to some pretty bad indie cards. But, you know, you go to an indie card and you kind of accept that you're not going to see, you know, it's like going to see a direct-to-video movie. You go there and you accept the fact that it's going to be a bad movie, but that's part of the fun. So, you know, going to a card that's bad, unintendedly bad. There was a couple of WWF cards I went to in the mid to late 80s that were not very good. But, certainly not to the level of an indie card. But, you know, part of the fun of going to the indie card is watching how bad it is. So, Barry, you've had a couple minutes. What do you think? What's your best?
John Doe. I'm still hanging on John Doe.
No, we're not giving him credit. Awesome. By God, this week we're not saying his name.
Gotcha. So the worst, I'm going to do worst card first, because I think that's easiest for me. So I went to a card about a year, maybe a year and a half ago, at the old ECW arena, which is now called the 2300 arena. And it was billed as a lucha show, and it was booked by Johnny Rods, the old WWF prelim guy.
The unpredictable Johnny Rods.
The unpredictable, also known as Java Rook. Which, yes. I think was just so cool. He didn't want to change the lettering on his boots or his tights, so why not just go with Java Rook? So, anyways, it was a card put on, and it was supposed to be a lucha card. They did bring in a couple of names. Sexy Star was there, the great Sexy Star.
And then, a little bit of controversy recently.
Just a little bit. And then they brought in one of the minis, actually two of the minis, to work against each other. Espectrito, I think it was. I'm sure I'm Espectre, Espectrito. I'm sure I'm butchering this. But the rest of the card was filled out by people who paid Johnny Rods to be trained at a school. And I got to tell you, it was next level terrible on several different. Now, I'm a guy that, again, I'm usually really positive. I could find a silver lining in any sort of situation. But this was arguably some of the worst. It wasn't wrestling, first off. I don't know what I mean. These guys, they couldn't lock up. They couldn't do anything. And I think at the end of the day, I kept saying, this is pretty bad, but I think somebody's going to get hurt, because these guys didn't know how to even bump. And then I read an article that apparently Johnny doesn't really do a whole lot at the school anymore and doesn't really train these guys correctly. And, you know, I don't know if that's true, but I did read an article that said that. but it was certainly visible that night in the ring. It was the worst I ever saw. The best card is a really, really difficult one for me to say, and I don't know if it's one card that really stands out. You know, certainly there are certain matches of certain cards that make it. Obviously, Terry Funk winning the NWA World Heavyweight title in Miami Beach was, as a wrestling fan, maybe the most impressionable thing that I had ever seen, because I remember the match clearly to this day. It's 42 years later. I was in the Omni the night that Dusty Rhodes was turned on by everyone, which was the Assassins, Ivan Koloff, and Ole Anderson. And we've talked about that previously, so that was a big deal. But we went to a couple of cards at in around the Knoxville, Tennessee area at the WFIA convention in 1978. And the big feud at the time, it was like Malenko was there, and Mongolian Stomper was there, and Ronnie Garvin was there, and it was pretty crazy because I had never seen Knoxville wrestling before, and there were similarities to Florida, but at the same time, they removed a lot of the wrestling, and it was just these brawls with this blood, and they were just going for it. And I remember walking away going, man, this was incredible. So I don't know if I can say one card, but you know, there were certain matches and certain highlights that really played a major role, I think, in my formation as a wrestling fan. So excellent, excellent question, John Doe. Excellent question.
Yeah, I can actually remember seeing, we used to go, my buddy and I used to go to West Palm Beach. Geez, they would run every Monday night. We'd probably hit like 35 Monday night shows in West Palm Beach. We actually would make a point of going there instead of down to Miami Beach. And especially, you know, I've said before, my favorite year was 1982, and seeing, you know, David Von Erich, seeing Butch Reed, seeing Bruiser Brody, John Studd was Bruiser Brody and John Studd were a really strong heel team. Brian Blair, Derek Draper, who was Ed Wiskowski, just lots of great stuff in that 1982 year. I saw, you know, Flair face Butch Reed in some great matches in West Palm Beach. So, you know, any of those cards would stick out with me too. So final question we're going to take from the message board here, Barry. This is a very deep, heavy question. As I was looking at it, I go, this is not just a yes or no question. You got to do some real thinking here. Barry, from Joseph Douglas. Thanks, Joseph, for the question. Do you think the difference in camera angles and shots from old school to new school make a difference on how we accept the product? Long shots, not showing the cooperation, et cetera, to where now the close-up shots, we see guys like John Cena and others talking to one another and saying things. What do you think?
I don't think so. But I think, hey, first off, you got to admit, these are really two excellent questions from Joseph Douglas and Mike Fahey. And it's, you know, a lot of times I sarcastically put up, does Barry Manilow know you rate his wardrobe guy? Which is, you know, that's kind of what I expect is this. And then you get these really kind of deep, you know, almost philosophical type questions when it comes to professional wrestling. I don't know if it really does on how we accept the product. Again, this is such, there's so many answers, and this is such a multi-sided answer when you're going to try to respond to a question like this. Again, this all goes back to, this is not the 1970s. Everything is different. You know, everybody listening to our podcast, this is the amazing thing too, Jeff, when you stop and think about it. Everybody listening to our podcast right now has a general idea on how professional wrestling works. And, you know, there's going to be varying degrees, varying levels of understanding the business. But at the same time, you know, unless you were in professional wrestling 30 years ago or 40 years ago, you didn't understand it. You know, you might have understood a couple of things, but you didn't. Now, because of the Observer, because of the internet, because the business is open, because the boys themselves talk about this all the time, we understand the business in a different way. So, you know, to say that the camera angles and shots, it's not really responsible. There's so many different reasons that things are different right now when we view the business differently. I don't think it's just what we're seeing as far as camera angles, et cetera. I don't know. What do you think?
No, I mean, I think you make some valid points. You know, I can remember, as you were giving your explanation there, I can remember back in the day when Gordon Solie, and I remember Bill Watts, you would see the guys maybe you know, kind of saying something to one another, and they would always cover it by going, you know, Bill Watts would say something like, ah, you can see they're talking to each other. They're talking some trash to one another. So as a way of covering the fact that the guys were calling a spot, Bill Watts would say, well, yeah, of course they talk to one another. He's sitting there telling him how he's going to whoop his behind. And that I thought was a brilliant way to cover the fact when you would see guys, you know, talking about a spot or, you know, being a little too open with what was going to happen. So I thought that was a great way of covering it. But it's a fair question. I agree, though. Times have changed. I don't necessarily even think that it was Dave Meltzer that changed with the Wrestling Observer. I mean, he was certainly a part of it. But I think that Terry Funk was right when he said that cable television complete, yep. You know, once he saw cable television more than anything changed the business and changed the industry, the way that it's perceived. You know, all of a sudden you were seeing a guy that was a guy that was in her second match in one territory. He would come to your territory. He was main eventing. You know, if that doesn't expose the business, you know, and Bill Apter can write only so many stories. You know, I'll never forget when Ted DiBiase came to the WWE as the Million Dollar Man, Bill Apter wrote a story about how the way this happened was that Ted DiBiase got some sort of inheritance from a family member, and that's why he's the Million Dollar Man. And Bill.
So here's something. So this is something I'm going to share with you, and this kind of ties along into this conversation. But during the first CWF Legends Fan Fest, which we did last June, so I had a chance to talk to Jody Hamilton, and Jody and I were talking, as you did as well, obviously. But Jody and I were talking, and I said, you know, one of the things that really impressed me when I would tell people about the assassin in later years was he used to do a knee drop. And I don't know if you remember, but you had a guy that was about 260, 280 pounds, and he would do this really vicious knee drop that it looked like he was going to slice through the top of the head of his opponent. And I remember mentioning to him, and I remember saying, you know, as a kid, I would sit there, and I was in the first and second row as a kid, and I would watch you do this knee drop where you would raise your knee, generally your right knee really high up, and then you would just come down, which Flair has been doing for years. And I said, you know, how did you do that where you didn't really injure the guy? And look, I understand how professional wrestling works. And he said, in all the years I did that move, never once did I ever hurt somebody by actually doing that. And I thought that was so cool because, again, I'm going back and I'm remembering what it was like 40 years ago. But to the point that Mike Fahey and Joseph Douglas brought up, especially Joseph Douglas with the camera angles, I kind of wonder, you know, if there had been something where, you know, like a pay-per-view or better camera. And the truth was the lighting was always terrible when they showed the matches in Florida. It wasn't great, you know, and the camera work wasn't amazing. We were limited with what we could actually do. But what if it had been better? Would the product look any less? And in my head, I would say absolutely not, because, again, I go with Jody Hamilton, and I would swear he was killing a guy.
Well, and, you know, those camera angles from back in the day was part of the appeal. You know, that's part of the mystery of what you were seeing. And, you know, the suspension of disbelief that we mentioned so often, that was part of the appeal. And oh, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, I got to be honest with you. If I was a kid growing up nowadays, would I be a fan of the WWE? I don't really think I would be. You know, I might have, you know, got a subscription to the WWE Network to access other kind of stuff. But, you know, like I said, I recently watched the NXT show, and I like that. But the WWE show just does not really hold a lot of interest for me. You know, am I going to watch WrestleMania to see AJ Styles and Nakamura if that match happens? Yeah, I'll probably watch it to watch that match. But, you know, I got no big interest in watching Brock Lesnar and you know, somebody. Or I certainly got no big interest in watching Stephanie McMahon and Ronda Rousey, for God's sakes. So
I have a question for you, and I think this is something that I've certainly have thought in my head. So this isn't a poke the bear, but this is kind of the question, which will go out to you and then go out to everybody who's listening to us right now. So I was out in San Diego this week, as we've mentioned five or six times at this point, and one of my favorite things when I'm on the West Coast to do is to go to In-N-Out Burger. And I always make a point to, you know, and this time there was no In-N-Out Burger right around the corner, but usually I can walk to one. So a group of us got in a cab, an Uber. If we paid $23 to go to In-N-Out Burger, where the combo meals are under $8. So let that sink in for a minute of the complete insanity of what we did. To that point, when you're in there, the manager walks around the tables and says, how was your experience today? Which is good. You know, when a restaurant does a table touch, how was your experience today? Is there anything we could be doing better? And as I sat there, the first thing that went through my head was, how many products out there, and I'm referencing the WWE, can put on a product and put out a product that people universally almost always shit on and then make no effort to change it? And part of the reason I bring that up is I like you know, a lot of their guys. This is not an indictment. Roman Reigns, I actually think, gets a raw deal from fans. At the same time, the fans have rejected him. And I disagree with that, but they have rejected him. How many businesses are out there can you continually ignore what the consumer wants and still be successful? And to me, it's amazing, because if In-N-Out Burger, or, you know, fuck In-N-Out Burger, we'll say McDonald's, which is one of the largest businesses in the entire world, if they were putting out a product and people said, man, this chicken sandwich tastes like shit, and continually said that electronically, you know, all over social media, I get a feeling McDonald's would wind up pulling the product. I mean, don't you? At the same time, the WWE put on a show over the last couple of nights where Brock Lesnar and Kane apparently wrestled like a 90-second match, and the fans apparently lost their mind and were booing. Those same fans will probably line up and buy tickets to the next event, though. So I've just wondered, and again, this is super, super long-winded, but how many businesses out there can consumers shit on the product and they don't make a change, where the WWE is really the leader of this?
Well, I'll tell you what immediately popped into my mind when you started talking about this. And first of all, you're absolutely right about one thing. There's nothing like a little bit of the old In-N-Out, but I digress.
Oh my God.
So, hey, whoa. The first thing I thought of when you were talking about, you know, the WWE, it's really the only game in town at this point, okay? But think back to the early 70s. Think back to Detroit when Dick the Bruiser brought in another promotion to square off against Ed Farhad and the Sheik, okay?
Yes.
And for a short period in time, there was a wrestling war in Detroit, and the fans in Detroit got to see some of the best wrestling in the country. Like, the cards were just loaded top to bottom. Bruiser ends up skipping town, goes back to his base, in whether it's Indianapolis or around Chicago, that kind of. And what you had for the next few years was Ed Farhat as the Sheik doing these main event matches that generously went maybe 5 minutes. And they were pretty much a routine where Ed would bring in some huge challenger. The match would go 5 minutes. It would always end at a DQ because Ed almost never lost by a pinfall. He had the United States every once in a great moon. He'd give it to Bobo Brazil for, you know, like a 6 month run or something like that. But then slowly, Ed started losing fans. And it was because the fans were sick of seeing the same finish over and over. And how many promotions have we seen? And I can name some right off the top of my head that refused to change the way they did their product and slowly lost the fans, and then at some point said, well, wait a minute, where the hell did all the fans go? Well, it's because you were idiotic and didn't change what you were doing to accommodate the fans who are your consumers. And Ed Farhad ended up going out of business because of it. And this is a guy that's probably one of the – probably the two or three greatest heels in the history of the industry. But because he was not willing to change the way his product was working, he fell by the wayside. And, you know – you really have to wonder. I mean, Vince McMahon, how old is Vince now? He's got to be, what, 70s, mid-70s maybe?
Oh, no,
even?
He's 70s. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
He's not going to be around forever. And so when this guy, who's the genius of the promotion, you know, for good Lord, 30, 40 years now, when this guy finally dies off, Paul Levesque has a lot on his shoulders if he's going to be the brains behind this promotion. And if he says, by God, I want it to be this way or no way, you know, he's going to end up costing himself a promotion and a $1 billion corporation. So they need to adjust. And, you know, credit to him for taking NXT and making that into a product that people can appreciate, because they changed. And I hope they can do that on top. And I hope they can recognize that, you know, when people don't, you know, one of the things I saw the Observer this week, Dave said that Rusev is getting a tremendous reaction that they're like ignoring. And that, you know, if a guy's hot and it wasn't something you created, who cares? Run with the fact that the guy's hot, you know? And if a guy's not hot, you need to, you know, change something about him. And you can't force feed the consumer a product, you know? Hey, how often, think about it. Remember back in the 80s, Barry, when Coke tried to push new Coke down the consumer's throats? Yeah, how'd that work out for you? And, you know, six months later, it's back to the old Coke, you know? And guess what? The WWE had better realize that if they want to become new Coke, you know, or old Coke, that they need to make some adjustments. That's what I'm saying quite kindly. Okay, folks. We're going to
That was excellent. So that was a really, really excellent point. And to that, I go back to Eddie Graham. So Eddie Graham, with all of his faults that he may have had, Eddie Graham apparently had this habit where he would come out and he would listen. He wouldn't look at the audience, but he would listen to the audience as far as reactions to figure out who was getting over and who wasn't. And then he would look at the audience as well. So again, you bring up Rusev. Rusev is arguably maybe the hottest thing going currently. The fans are into him right now. So why don't they push him to the moon based off of that? They don't, which makes zero sense. Roman Reigns, which again, I disagree with, is universally despised by a lot of fans, but they're pushing him to the moon. So again, you're completely ignoring what the consumer wants and you're pushing your own agenda. And I'm not sure that there's any other business on the face of the earth that could actually get away with that. I do want to bring up In-N-Out Burger for a minute. Oh, my God. So I hadn't been in In-N-Out Burger. I went last year when I was in Los Angeles, and I hadn't been in a year. And I think I went 4 times in 5 days last year because I loved the place. But I did something I had never done before at In-N-Out Burger. If you've never been to In-N-Out Burger, and Jeff, thank God you have, it is west of the Mississippi. They will not come on the other side of the Mississippi, and it has to do with product freshness, et cetera. But you'll find them out. I believe they're in Oregon. They're in Washington, Arizona, Vegas, obviously all throughout California. But I ordered the meal, which is the double-double. I got the fries with animal sauce. I got a beverage. And then I sat there and I said, you know, you may not be out here again for another year, you fat bastard. You should get another double-double. And I did. And the first time in my life, I ate 2 double-doubles. And then I got a milkshake. And then all night long, I paid for it. But man, was it good.
Okay. Next week, we're going to be discussing the culinary habits of Barry Rhodes. Oh, I think that's the point where you posted and I said, yeah, way to go, fat ass. Welcome to my world. So
You did. Hey, can I bring up one more thing as I do a complete hijack? So on the questions, and I pulled this up, and I just think this is a fun one too. Joe Kavinsky, and I don't know if that's a silent C where it's K-A-C-V, but Joe Kavinsky said best 80s TV show. I know mine, Jeff, right off the top of my head. How about you?
I got to be honest with you. The 80s were when I first got married, so my TV watching was more limited. Give me your show, and I'll see if it sparks anything.
So, in my show is almost a cheat because even though it started in the 80s, it became popular in the 90s. It's Cheers, and Cheers is in my top 5 TV shows of all time, but even top 3. I love Cheers. Even to this day, I love Cheers.
You know, I got to be honest with you. I'll have to post because I'm drawing a complete blank. Because I, you know, when I think back, my favorite shows of all time. You know, I as a kid, Hogan's Heroes was my favorite show. Then I went through a period where I skipped, and I really, you know, I had the Seinfeld, The Office, which we're going to talk about The Office one of these episodes coming up. Yeah. I was a big fan of The X-Files, but I'm just drawing a blank on the 80s here.
Yeah, well, you can go. Like, you weren't going to say The Cosby Show, I hope.
I was not. That's another episode we're going to do. Shows that were popular that I've never seen one single episode of ever. And The Cosby Show, Survivor, all these shows I've never seen. What's the one with the Big Bang Theory? I've never seen a single episode of that. So, Barry, what's a big name show that you've never seen a single episode of?
I'm sure it exists. I don't know. I have to think of Mad Men. Sons of Anarchy. I mean, it's a big name show. Sons of Anarchy, which apparently is fantastic. And I think when I realized what a great show. From listening to everybody else, it was maybe third season. And at that point, I was like, well, I can't start watching it. It's on Netflix. I want to watch it. I just need to put forth the month, I guess, to get through it. But that's like number one on my list, Sons of Anarchy.
Yeah. Folks, I don't know if you could tell, but because Barry was in San Diego all week and he had some power problems this weekend with getting his power restored, this show is going to be kind of all over the map. We don't really have a big structure for this. So finally, we're going to discuss Barry's all-time dream girl, Pam Grier. So Barry had told me, oh, you got to see this movie, Coffee. And Pam Grier was in a lot of blaxploitation movies in the early 70s. She was a absolutely beautiful woman. She was still beautiful when she made Jackie Brown for Quentin Tarantino. But Barry, I know you want to tell everyone just how great Coffee is. And then I'll give you some thoughts on what I thought of after having a chance to have seen this movie.
Yeah, absolutely, too. So Coffee is, it may be Pam's arc. It might be her biggest role and her best role, but she plays a character named Coffee, obviously, and she is a nurse, and her younger sister is addicted to drugs, and she decides that she's going to take out the pushers and the pimps and all the street trash who have kind of destroyed her sister, and she doesn't care how she's going to do it. And she's great. And, you know, partly with Pam, I think when I look is that she was actually a really good actress, too. You know, you don't always see it in these movies because these movies didn't call for good acting. But at the same time, her body, and if you have any appreciation for the female physique, her body might be the most perfect body of all time. She's not bone thin. She's not, you know, heavy by any stretch. At the same time, she's curvy. Her breasts are spectacular. And apparently, I remember as I was, as I got into the blaxploitation genre, which was about 20 years ago, when I just, you know, I really started watching a lot of these movies. And I did a little research, and Pam Grier was kind of like this. So this is not going to be safe for work for the next couple of minutes, but Pam Grier was, there were parallels with Pam Grier to Linda Lovelace of Deep Throat fame. And I don't mean it in the porn aspect, but I mean it in the sense that there was, Linda Lovelace took porn out of the basement and kind of made it mainstream. And at the same time, there was a bunch of very well-known celebrities who were having sex with Linda Lovelace because of what they had seen on screen. So with Pam Grier, once she started doing these movies and a lot of, you know, famous men were seeing it, they were either trying to bed her or were actually bedding her. And I think Warren Beatty was a real famous name of a guy that was actually with both Linda Lovelace and Pam Grier. Warren Beatty with everybody, apparently. So I am a huge fan. But when this movie, and the whole blaxploitation thing is interesting to me, because when you hear a term like blaxploitation, the first thing that pops into your head is exploitation. You're exploiting black people. And I don't really feel that's the case because, you know, and again, I'm not the right person to judge because I'm not black or African American. But at the same time, this kind of gave black people a voice in film when they previously didn't have it. But the marketing of this film was great. And I pulled a newspaper ad, which I'll post in the group. And I just thought it's so early 70s kind of cheesy. And it says black coffee, hot coffee, and sweet coffee. They call her Coffee and she'll cream you. And I was just like thinking, so who's the genius who came up with that one? And then the next one, it said, she's got a body men would die for. And lately, a lot of them have. So I just thought, well, somebody is in, you know, in some one room apartment somewhere just writing this shit up. But this is a really fun movie. And, you know, it's got, in my opinion, it's got one of the great bad guys of all time. And I know you and I were talking about some of the stars of the film and Sid Haig, who I'm just a huge fan of Sid Haig, whether it's Spider Baby or any of these blaxploitation films or even the stuff that he's done, you know, over the last few years working with Rob Zombie. He's just a great, I'll tell you a great Sid Haig story. And I may have told you this previously. And as Jeff mentioned, yes, we really are all over the place because I'm on no sleep. I've been in San Diego and I came back and I've had no power, but I go to all these monster cons, which I don't think I've mentioned over the last couple of episodes, and Sid Haig is a fixture. And you can go to these monster cons, and you could have the biggest star possible there, and they may have 20 people, and Sid Haig will have 100 people. So Sid Haig is known for saying, fuck you. And he'll just say, fuck you to you. And he doesn't mean it meanly. It's just meant to be like a greeting. And he signs all of his pictures, fuck you, Sid Haig. So my son was probably 15 years old at the time, maybe 14. He went into the bathroom and Sid Haig walks in and they're standing at the urinals together. And my son looks over and he goes, holy fucking shit, Sid Haig. And he looks over at my son and goes, fuck you. So my kid comes out of the bathroom and he's like, Dad, you're not going to believe it. And it was like the highlight of the entire thing for him. But Sid Haig's in this one. But the bad guy that I was referring to is the guy that plays her boyfriend. And boy, you know, this to me is some real heel heat, because I remember watching this movie, and I watched Coffee maybe 2 months ago. I've actually got it on my DVR. And I remember when you discover that the boyfriend is the bad guy, is the heel, and I'm like, mother effer. I was just so pissed. So, yeah, so I love this movie for so many different reasons. It's got Robert Doakie in it. Robert Doakie, who is a lot of people would know. He was in a lot of TV shows and movies in the 70s. He was the desk sergeant in RoboCop, and I think he was in RoboCop 1 and 2. So he's in the movie. But just a really fun movie. And even though I know the criticisms of this movie, some of the acting is subpar, the direction is maybe first year film student direction, you'll never be bored when you watch a Pam Grier movie. I mean, you could say, again, you can criticize what you want, but boredom's not really something that actually plays into it. And I'm going to toss this over to you, because I know you and I were discussing one of the many fight scenes, and you had some notes that you had taken on the one of the fights.
Well, before I get to the fight scenes, I will also mention that also in the movie is an actor named Alan Arbus. Alan Arbus is well known to television viewers as Dr. Sidney Friedman from the TV show MASH. He was a recurring character on MASH. And what's great is he is completely removed from that character, because he has this kind of fro. And it reminded me of when Al Pacino, I think, played who was the music producer that was alleged to have killed his girlfriend?
Phil Spector.
Phil Spector, yeah, when he had the ridiculous afro, and so Alan Arbus kind of has the white guy fro going in this, and looks kind of ridiculous, but it's like, here I see him, and I go, oh my God, that's the guy from MASH. So the actor, just to give credit where it's due, who plays the lead heel, as Barry alluded to, is an actor named Booker Bradshaw, who's indeed very good in this. So there's two fight scenes in this movie in particular. There's one where the main pimp, who, as Barry alluded to earlier, is Robert, I believe it's Doakie. Is that how you say it, Barry, you think?
I think it's Doakie, yeah.
Okay, he's the main pimp, and he's got a bunch of his ladies at this party, and there's a fight that ensues between Pam Grier and a couple other women, and it's a pretty good cat fight. You know, what do you call, you're waiting for the wrestling announcer to go, cat fight! And they're doing some good hair pulling. There's a couple of bras that get pulled down for some gratuitous boob shots. But then there's a fight later on between her, and she's trying to get information from someone. And she has a fight, and it's between her and let's just say a lesbian. And the lesbian's kind of butchier girlfriend comes in, and it probably is one of the worst fight scenes I've ever seen in my life, because it looks so incredibly staged, which was amazing because the fight scene before had been really well done. And I go, I can't believe these two fights are in the same movie, because one was so well done and the other one is a complete crap fest. So I don't know how those two got in the same movie, but yeah, no, this is a lot of entertainment. You know, as you said, Pam Grier is absolutely gorgeous. She was great in Jackie Brown, and she's really good in this. I haven't seen many more of her movies, but I know she had a real run where she was a pretty well-known actress and pretty prolific in the early to mid-70s.
Yeah, she definitely was, too. And so here's a cool thing about this movie, too, the fact that she hides a lot of her weapons in her afro. Which I just think is great. She's hiding her weapons there. But this was essentially the movie that kind of made her You know, again, she made several of these blaxploitation films, but she this was the movie that kind of, you know, sent her to the next level. And she made Foxy Brown, which was released, I think, less than a year that this movie came out, which also kind of made a big deal. You know, Pam Grier was, when you said blaxploitation, one name comes up, and it's Pam, you know, absolutely. So, yeah, it's highly recommended. You know, we've talked. Foxy Brown is great. Sheba Baby was great. You know, I don't think Pam could do anything wrong. And I saw a recent photo of her maybe a year or two ago, and she still looked good. And I'm going to assume she's 70 years old. She's got to be close to it.
She's got to be getting close.
If Coffee was made in 73, you know, and she was 23, you know, right, she's got to be close to 70 at this point.
68.
She's 68. So she was, wow. So how old was she then? So she was 68.
So she would have been like 25-ish when she made that. Yeah. When she made.
Yeah.
Coffee. By the way, according to IMDb, the idea for hiding the weapons in her afro that was Pam Grier's idea herself. So
genius.
Just yeah, good stuff.
Great set of breasts, and she's a genius.
And also, you know, not to hijack this the movie thread here, but I was telling Barry I had a chance. I took one for the team because I actually did not want to go see this movie, but my wife was interested in going to see the new Death Wish movie that just came out with Bruce Willis playing the role of Paul Kersey. You know, the original with Charles Bronson, I remember it was pretty controversial at the time. And I'm old enough to remember being a young teenager when it came out, I want to say 74, 75. But it was a really, really good action movie, really good revenge film. I mentioned to my wife, Charles Bronson, Barry, I know you remember his films. He was one of these guys that he'd say maybe 50 words of dialogue in a movie. But, you know, those squinty eyes and that yep. menacing look on his face, he said more with his eyes and his face than a lot of actors say with, you know, 600 words of dialogue. But so I go see this new Death Wish movie. And where do I begin? First of all, you know, if you're looking for a solid action movie with some good shootings and you know, the like, you know, it's just right up your alley. But I started really thinking about this movie, and I know it's directed by a guy that Barry's a big fan of, which is Eli Roth. And I know Eli Roth had something to do with Inglourious Basterds. Was he the director or the writer, or where was it? What was it, Barry?
I think he was – he may have been – so he's good friends with Tarantino. He may have – done some of the writing, but he was the character known as the Bear Jew that would carry around the baseball bat and bash in Nazis' heads.
Okay, gotcha. So, but he's a well-known director. He did Cabin Fever. He did Hostel Part 2, which is a genre that has come to be known as involving what they call torture porn, where you do a torture scene that's so graphic that for people who are into that kind of thing, it's almost has a visceral response. So there's a scene in this movie where you get one guy, I'm not going to reveal who this involves, but you get a guy that takes a knife and cuts a guy in the back of the leg and then pours brake fluid on it to cause maximum pain, because he's cutting the guy right along the sciatic nerve in the back of the leg. And, you know, then there's a couple scenes where you get the extreme close up of someone, you know, being injured or killed in an extremely graphic way. And, you know, I'm sitting there watching that and I'm going, unfortunately, I've seen it before. I'm a little desensitized to it. But when my wife and I left the theater, we looked, and as we're walking out, we saw a couple walking out with what appeared to be their 11 or 12 year old child. And I thought to myself, what the hell are you doing bringing your 11-year-old to see this movie for? I mean, you know, have a little bit of parental responsibility. You know, it's one thing if you have a child who's a little bit older, but I would like to think, Barry, that you wouldn't bring your daughter. Maybe your son is a little bit older, but your daughter at her age, I don't know if she's ready to see this kind of film. And, you know, it just really bothered me to see parents bringing a child that young to a movie that's going to have this kind of violence, because you got to know, first of all, the subject matter of the movie. You know, Charles Bronson, he used a handgun. Let's just say they've upgraded the weaponry in this current Death Wish, and Bruce Willis plays a doctor. I have never seen a less convincing doctor than Bruce Willis in this movie. So I got to tell you, Barry, I know you still want to go see this. You told me you wanted to check it out. But
I do.
On the Jeff Bowdren scale, I'm giving it a thumbs down. So
yeah, it's so it's one understanding all the flaws too. And Eli Roth, his movies are, even though I'm a fan of his work, it's not without notice that his movies can be really hard to take. He did a movie 2 or 3 years ago called The Green Inferno, which actually starred his very hot wife, who I believe is of Italian descent, just smoking. And The Green Inferno is essentially about people that are, I believe, in the Amazon, somewhere over South or Central America, and their plane goes down, and they're essentially held hostage by a group of cannibals, and they get tortured, brutally tortured. It's extremely graphic. It's definitely not for everybody. And it's a hard thing for me to sit here and try to explain if you're not into this style of film. And, it's hard for me to explain why I like this style of film. because it is so brutally graphic, but it's essentially an extension of a horror movie, which is, and I love horror and science fiction, and, these are my types of movies. But The Green Inferno was the apex of just torture porn. And Hostel also. Hostel had some scenes that were, but to that end, I am a huge Bruce Willis fan. I do want to see this movie. Understanding all the flaws that go along with it, it's not going to keep me. I was going to go today. I most likely will go tomorrow. But this does beg the question, has Bruce Willis's career really fallen so far that these are the kind of movies he's making now?
I think the answer is yes.
Yeah. All right.
One of the things, Bruce Willis has because he's bald, you don't really notice the guy that's like losing his hair or becoming gray. So he's kind of been able to hide the fact that he's getting older. And, Bruce Willis is now 62. And, in the movie, he is married to, Elizabeth Shue from Adventures in Babysitting. And I'm sitting here watching the movie. I look at my wife and I go, that's the girl from Adventures in Babysitting, now playing Bruce Willis's wife. I think I've gotten a little bit older. So, it's got Vincent D'Onofrio, who's a very good character actor, who I think is incredibly wasted in this movie because his character essentially does nothing other than be the brother of Bruce Willis. But I looked at Bruce Willis and I'm going, he looks older and he looks kind of tired in this movie. Anyway, so now we're going to going to switch gears here, Barry. We're going to get back to our top five list. And for the first time, I believe our top five list is going to go wrestling related. We are going to talk about our top five most underrated promo guys of all time. Yeah, you ask somebody, who's the best promo guy in the history of the business? You get your The Rock, you get your Jerry Lawler, you get your people like that, Jim Cornette, Bobby Heenan. But there are guys that are great that are kind of a little bit under the radar that people don't appreciate just how good they were. And so Barry and I came up with a top five list all. We're not going to go too deep into this. Barry, give me your number five guy. And this doesn't have to be in any particular order, but just give me your top five.
Yeah, and I will. I mean, with the extension of maybe number one or number two, the other three would be on the rotation, which it is for most every week. Every week that we do a top five. So for me, number five is King Curtis. So I was really fortunate to see King Curtis when he first came to Florida, which was 1975. And he was, so physically, he was this super imposing guy, a little over 6 feet tall, 300 pounds, long, flowing almost to the middle of the back, this black grayish hair, a forehead which was a road map. But when he opened his voice, it was like this bellowing would come out, and he would, Dusty Rhodes, and I'm not going to start doing promos right now in my basement, but he would have this shouting voice, and he commanded attention, and it was so cool because even when you saw him in the arenas, he would do that. And you could be in an arena at Miami Beach Convention Center with 4,000 other people, and if King Curtis starts shouting in the ring, the guy in the farthest seat away was able to hear it. So he had this unique style, which was really captivating, but at the same time, he was trippy. There's a lot of stories about King Curtis with hallucinogenics and Mark Lewin, and they did a lot of drugs, and that really contributed to his style. But if you've ever heard Curtis, and I was really fortunate, there's a guy, Dean Dean Araki, I think is his name, or Aragaki, and I'm butchering all these names today, but he's a hardcore fan that lives in Hawaii, and he sent me a DVD of interviews from guys from Hawaii maybe 10 years ago, and a lot of it is Curtis, and when you just listen to it, you go, what was he on? But man, is this cool. So for me, my number five is Curtis.
Yeah, no, he was, and you know, he's a guy that really influenced a lot of, you can see his influence on guys like Kevin Sullivan, certainly, you know, and he's somebody that when you talk to veterans about who are the great promo guys, that's a name that consistently comes up. So in my number five, what I like about this guy is I like a guy that can work babyface and heel, and a guy that came to my mind, I did not see enough of this guy because his career was winding down, by the time I really started becoming more interested, and that's Killer Carl Cox. And Killer Carl Cox famously had an invisible friend named Alex. He worked a crazy gimmick, and he would talk to Alex. And he'd be in the middle of the interview talking to Gordon Solie, and he'd go, that's right, Gordon, I'm going to be in Tampa on such and such a night. I'm going to be facing what? What? And he'd look up at the ceiling, and he'd go, Alex? Yeah, okay. And Gordon would just have this look like, what is he doing? And that was part of the appeal of Killer Carl Cox. Killer Carl Cox also as a babyface was one of the most famous angles that I can remember in Florida. And I want to say early 1982 when Killer Carl Cox came out and exposed that the Iron Sheik was not from Saudi Arabia, that he was from Iran. And he did this great thing where he showed these pictures of the Iron Sheik standing with the Shah of Iran. And he said, and I love details like this. He said, you know, Gordon, as a military veteran, I used the power of the Freedom of Information Act, used my contacts in the Pentagon to get these photos. And it was so stinking believable that, you know, that he did this. And it was just such an awesome interview. So, yeah, Killer Carl Cox, my number five, Bear.
And that's great, too. And so two quick points, and I don't want to make this a 12-hour show, which it seems like we're going to be going today. But in later years, Rick Steiner, his entire gimmick was based off of that. And Dusty Rhodes, who had seen Cox, gave him this imaginary friend. But do you know the origins of Alex? I never knew this until about a year ago. So our old friend, referee Bruce Owens, who was a referee for CWF, and you and I have both known him for so many years, he was really good friends with Cox when Cox was in Florida. And apparently, Cox was, this goes way back in his career, 60s, I believe, and Cox was at a new facility for wrestling. And he was in the middle of the ring, and somebody had spray painted the name Alex, I guess, on the rafters. So he's in the ring with the referee, and he's pointing at Alex, at somebody, the name written on the side of the rafters, and he's pointing at it. And I guess somehow the fans kind of took to that at that moment, and he started doing that town to town. But I never understood how you started with Alex. I thought that was so cool.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting stuff. Okay, number four.
Number four, Cowboy Bill Watts. So this is just like Cox, and I got to say I love Cox, by the way. Cowboy Bill Watts was a great interview as whether he was a heel or a babyface. And even when he was a babyface, he was still a little bit of a heel. Like there was never a complete difference. But Cowboy Bill Watts, and if you ever listen to the commentary that he did when he sat down with Gordon Solie, and you can find this on YouTube, he is so good. He had, in my opinion, he was light years ahead of so many other guys when it came to logically being able to explain something, and at the same time being able to be a little bit heelish and a little bit babyface every time he spoke. So I know one of the highlights for me whenever I watch an old Florida video, and if Watts is involved, it's listening to him talk with Gordon because his promos are just fantastic.
No, you know, one of the things I loved about him when he was a wrestler is that, you know, the old, I believe we've credited to Gary Hart, that the heel has to believe that what he's saying is right. And nobody did that better than Bill Watts as a heel. Yeah. I can recall watching angles where he was explaining himself to Gordon Solie. Well, the reason I did this, Gordon, is because of this. And, you know, he would just, it would make perfect sense to him as he was explaining to the viewer. Also, as a promoter, nobody ever did a better job as a promoter and getting over an angle and identifying little key. I'll give you a perfect example. When they had the famous angle with Ted DiBiase, Ric Flair, and Dick Murdoch, and Ted DiBiase, who was the lead heel in the territory, had now been attacked by his old teacher, Dick Murdoch, and is back in the dressing room. And Bill Watts came back on before they were going to, you know, have the match. And, you know, they were going to announce that DiBiase was going to come back on. And he says, you know, folks, I just want you to know that Ted DiBiase has been injured very badly. So you parents out there, I want to tell you that Ted DiBiase is bloody, but we've applied a pressure bandage to the wound to stop the flow of blood. And Ted DiBiase is going to come out here and wrestle. And I just thought that the talking about using a pressure bandage on a wound, like who thinks of that? You know, yeah. It was just a brilliant job of him, you know, and even his, when he would do his comebacks and in the UWF and in Mid-South, I remember one of my favorite interviews of all time was when he was going to New Orleans to, I can't remember who he was going to team up with. And I think he might've been facing the Russians, you know, and he's going, you know, he's in the back. He's out in the driveway and he's loading up his car to go to New Orleans. And he says, Maggie, give me a bat. Give me one made out of American pine. Those are the ones that I like to use. And it's like he's specifying the type of wood that he wants his wife to pick out, you know, to make his run to New Orleans. So, yeah, no, Dick Murdoch is tremendous. So so my next choice, I am going. We just mentioned that. Just mentioned this name, Dick Murdoch. Is my number four. Dick Murdoch was a guy that we've talked about him before on this show about guys that could have been the NWA champion. And Dick Murdoch had so much fun clowning around, but he would do interviews. I'm going to talk about some of the interviews that he did from the mid to late 80s when there was a point when the UWF was bought out by Jim Crockett. And they sent Dick Murdoch to work with Eddie Gilbert. If you ever get a chance to watch some of that stuff, it is absolute gold where they did some sort of, what was it, the top 10 list of challengers. Yeah. You remember that? And he put up Carl Cox's shoot name, and Jim Ross hadn't seen the list, and he turned it, and he sees the name Herb Gerwig, and Jim Ross about lost it on camera because he knew that was Killer Carl Cox's shoot name. And then, you know, there's a great clip on YouTube where they're sitting there talking, and Dick Murdoch actually says to the crowd in TBS studios, "Shut up, you bunch of kayfabers!" And, you know, and then they did a great skit where he was with Jim Cornette at the Midnight Express, and they were going to do some sort of gimmick tag team match, and Jim Cornette says something about how Misty Blue is in love with Dick Murdoch. Do you remember that interview?
I do. Because, yes, I do. Yes,
what does he say? He said something, you know, Jim Cornette says there's nothing that Misty Blue likes more than Dick. Or he made some sort of, you know, subtle double entendre, and like the expression, you know, Murdoch like jumps up and looks at Jimmy because he can't believe he said that. But no, Dick Murdoch was a great character, a guy we lost too young, you know, but tremendous. Okay. Number three.
Number three for me, and I don't know if this one counts, Terry Funk. And I only say this because I'm going back to the Terry Funk of the 1970s and maybe the early 80s, not ECW, and he certainly was great. But, you know, there's a couple that really come into mind. And I think one was the Florida Cracker interview, the promo he did where he's pouring the oil all over himself. And I remember reading in the book after that the oil got in his eyes and it affected his vision. But Terry Funk was a guy that, you know, he sold tickets when he did his promos. You know, you had two guys, in my opinion, you had two guys in Florida. You had Dusty Rhodes on the babyface side, and you had Terry Funk on the heel side. And when they did their interviews, you were going to buy your tickets, which really was the name of the game. So Terry Funk, is he underrated? Maybe not. Maybe that's just, you know. But again, I'm looking at a certain time frame here, which I'm going back to territory days. And Terry Funk was so ahead of the curve that, you know, everything that he was doing in 1974, people were now doing in 1994. So that, in my opinion, that Terry Funk was a trendsetter.
Yeah, no, I can't argue with that. I don't know that you could ever call Terry Funk underrated. But I can see where you're talking about the earlier part of his career where he was doing stuff that, you know, people haven't had access to or haven't seen, as opposed to the ECW stuff or the WCW stuff, you know. But no, he was unquestionably one of the real greats. You know, I was sitting there as you were talking about that. I was thinking, I remember when we were talking about great promo men once, our old friend of the show, Pete Lederberg, once said that his favorite all-time promo guy was Jerry Lawler. And I know Pete, truth be known, is a huge Jerry Lawler mark. I think Pete would admit that. But one of the things that Pete said to me that really resonated with me when he talked about why he thought Jerry Lawler was great was he said Jerry Lawler had to go out and sell himself to the same demographic and the same audience every single weekend for the better part of 20 years, if not longer, 20, 25 years even. And that guy put himself over to the fans and was able to have the fans coming back week after week. And there were ebb and flows in the crowd, certainly. But he put himself over every week and was creative about it. You know, there was nobody going, oh, God, Jerry Lawler's doing the same interview. And let's be honest, we both love Ric Flair. But a lot of Ric Flair interviews were exactly the same. He covered the same points, Space Mountain, you know, all this kind of stuff. Jerry Lawler was able to change things up. You know, he was like a pitcher with more than one pitch. He wasn't a one-trick pony. He changed up things. And I'm not saying Ric Flair was a one-trick pony, just for the record. But, you know, he was a guy that changed up his delivery. He changed characters. And he had to, because the same audience was watching him every single week for 20 to 25 years, which is absolutely effing amazing that he was able to do that. And Pete's right, and he should get credit for that. So I'm going now. I guess we're talking about my number three. Where am I at? Number three? I'm good with numbers, as these people who listen to this show know. Dutch Mantel. Dutch Mantel is a guy that doesn't give enough credit, because I recently had a chance to watch an angle from 1982 where Dutch and the aforementioned Jerry Lawler were getting into a situation, and they were having a match where the loser was going to – it was a TV studio match where the loser was going to leave town, and so Jerry and Dutch agreed to it. They're having this fight, and Dutch just, for whatever reason, can't get past Lawler's defenses. He'll throw a punch to Lawler. Lawler returns it. And at some point, Dutch rolls out of the ring and he says, you know, Jerry, what are you doing this for? What are we fighting each other for? You know, you got to be the toughest man I've ever faced in my whole career. You know, I've hit you with my best shots and you're coming back. And by God, you know, we're only doing this for our own egos. Why are we helping out the guys that are back in the dressing room right now who are loving watching us fight? And, you know, of course, I'm just talking about one angle here. He had a whole career of doing effective, well-done interviews. And he ends up turning on Lawler after he, you know, sucks Lawler in. But he sucked the crowd in, too, because I'd never seen the angle before. So I was watching and going, okay, where are they going to go with this? And then, of course, he does the switcheroo and attacks Lawler and, you know, gets the win on him. But it was so well done, and it was so well done because Dutch Mantel did a great job of selling that interview, and he's, you know, something that he did over his whole career.
Yeah, Dutch was really underrated too, and I think in the ring also. You know, outside of Tennessee, whether it was Memphis or Nashville, I don't know that Dutch ever got this huge run anywhere. You know, correct me if I'm wrong on that one too, but he was really good, and I'm not sure what it was. I know in Florida he had a pretty good run. He was also the booker, so he was booking himself in main events and against Ric Flair, etc. But as a promo guy, he was kind of flawless, and if you ever listen to Dutch's promos, he never screwed up. I mean, his diction was perfect. He knew what to say. And you could say that about a lot of those Memphis guys. That, you know, a lot of those Memphis guys really, when it came to doing their promo work, that was such a major, major, huge part of what they were presenting. In Florida, that wasn't always the case. You know, I don't think Jack and Jerry Briscoe were ever strong promo guys in Florida. They weren't. You know, Dusty certainly was. Mike Graham, Steve Kern, they were adequate, but I wouldn't have ever called them strong promo guys. But for some reason, you get to Memphis and everybody's a strong promo guy there.
Sure. So who's your number two?
Number two is Ernie Ladd. So Ernie Ladd, what I like about Ernie Ladd was great. Ernie Ladd appeared to be having so much fun whenever he was doing a promo, especially as a heel. And he would always create this, you know, Mr. TV announcer, and, you know, you're a chicken thief. And he would say all these things. And he was just a guy that I always felt when the interview was over, he was probably laughing to himself because he just seemed like he was having so much fun. And Ernie Ladd was great. He was another one that, you know, he had a great physical presence. So when he spoke, and he had kind of not a raspy voice, maybe a deep kind of throaty voice. And his interviews were always spot on. And he was, even as a baby face, he was good because he was never this traditional, I'm going to kiss babies and I love everybody type of baby face. He was still kind of this badass. But once he turned heel, he was like, everybody was fair game. There was nobody that wasn't fair game. And, you know, with Ernie too, he would say these things that were borderline outrageous back in the day, you know, for going back 30 and 40 and 50 years ago, but always entertaining. And he never wasted his breath. Ernie would give these promos that only lasted maybe 2 minutes, but you were able to take away all these sound bites after 2 minutes. So I love Ernie Ladd.
Yeah, I think one of my all-time favorite Ernie Ladd memories is Ernie Ladd was doing a promo in Georgia, I want to say 80, 81-ish, around that time frame, and he's talking to Gordon Solie, and at the end of the interview, he turns back to Gordon and he says, "Gordon, I smell whiskey." And I just absolutely died laughing when he said that to Gordon, and Gordon just completely stonewalls him, but it was so priceless when he said that to Gordon. He was definitely top-notch interviewers, no question about it. Okay, my number two, also well-known from Georgia Championship Wrestling, is Bob Armstrong, the Georgia Jawjacker. Bob Armstrong had a great rap, and, you know, we've talked about the Armstrong family before. I was always such a huge fan of Brad, who he lost way, way too young, and I always have said that if Brad could talk like his old man, he would have had a run with that title for sure, because he was that talented in the ring. But his dad, you know, so many one-liners, you know, jackass can't run with a racehorse. Apparently he delivered it better than I did. But he also famously said to Roddy Piper when they were having a face-off one day, "It's like mind over matter. I don't mind because you don't matter." And he just had a habit. I don't know where he would get these one-liners from, but he'd throw them out. And to compete verbally with Roddy Piper in a situation, think about that Roddy Piper stood there with Bob Armstrong, and Bob Armstrong held his own with him on the microphone. That speaks volumes of how good Bob Armstrong was, but nobody remembers that. And Bob Armstrong, what a great job we remember him doing in Smoky Mountain as the commissioner. And when Jimmy Cornette would get in his face and he'd say, "Well, you know, I got this clip-on tie." And he'd always take off that little clip-on tie.
Yeah.
And Bob was a great, great promo guy that people don't remember.
Yeah, he really was too. And Bob as a wrestler, you know, I certainly may catch a little bit of flack, but I don't think he was ever the greatest wrestler. But to your point, it was his promo ability that he was able to connect with the audience. And he had this charisma that he was able to connect with everybody sitting there watching wrestling, that he became one of the most popular wrestlers. So he was one of the most popular guys in Florida, in an area where we had tremendous wrestlers. He was one of the most popular guys all throughout the South, but in Georgia as well. And you had some of the best wrestling in the country taking place in Georgia. And Bob was already older at that point, but he's over, because when he spoke, the fans would listen to him and they were able to connect with him. So that's an excellent, excellent choice right there.
I appreciate you pointing that out for the fans. Okay, Barry.
Absolutely.
Number one most underrated promo guy of all time. Who's your choice?
Oh, man. So I alluded to this earlier when I was talking about this vicious knee drop that could cut the top of a man's head open. But it's the Assassin. And the Assassin was the first heel that I think truly made an impression on me, because he was doing interviews completely different than any other heel I'd ever seen before. He never raised his voice, and when he did, there was a reason for it, but he talked in almost these hushed, menacing tones, and menacing is the key word right there. And the original Assassin, Jody Hamilton, when he did a promo, you listened. It was borderline frightening. When he threatened Dusty Rhodes, you listened and you believed it, because he wasn't acting. He wasn't a guy that was screaming at the top of his lungs and cutting a promo. It was more of a guy just talking and telling you what he was going to do. And, you know, I remember years later, and the closest I can put to him would be Ole Anderson followed by Arn Anderson. And Ole was another one that was kind of like, he scared you a little bit because he was this menacing guy. He wasn't this over the top. And, you know, we used to love Ox Baker, but at the same time, I kind of knew Ox Baker was putting forth an act the way he would do his promos.
I'll tell you why the guys that you just mentioned were great. It's because they weren't playing a monster. They were playing like a school bully. And
yeah,
that's exactly what Jody Hamilton was, probably better than it, you know. And I agree with your points as to Ole Anderson and Arn Anderson, and both great. But Jody Hamilton was so sinister as the school bully that was the guy you were going to have to face every single day. And that was your own personal demon that you had to conquer, that school bully, that the guy that pushed you in the hallway and made you, you know, afraid for your, you know, for your safety, and in a real sinister way. And that's exactly what Jody Hamlin's a great choice, Barry. You know, a guy, again, that I've alluded to was at the very first match and one of the guys that hooked me into becoming a pro wrestling fan.
Yeah. And to this day, you know, you and I are still fans, and it is because of guys like Jody Hamlin. Absolutely.
Okay, time for my number one. My number one choice for the most underrated promo guy of all time is a guy that not enough people have seen, because if his run during, dare I say, the late 70s through the early to mid 80s in Portland, when Buddy Rose was on top of the pro wrestling scene in Portland, he had a brief run in New York. Everybody remembers him as being Mr. 217. The announcer would say, from Portland, Oregon, at 271 pounds. And Buddy would grab the mic and go, that's 217 pounds, which, by the way, was a brilliant gimmick. I don't know who gave it to him, but it was absolutely sensational. But, boy, if you get a chance to pull up any of Buddy's stuff, I almost said Barry's stuff, your brother, Playboy Buddy Rose, Barry.
Absolutely.
But his stuff from the late 70s through the early 80s with – Ed Wiskowski and other guys out there was tremendous. And here again, much like we talked about Lawler, a guy that had to sell himself to the same audience week after week after week. And there was a run of guys going through Portland that was just crazy, because Don Owen was a promoter that everyone in the business respected so much. You know, you were never going to get rich working in Portland. Let's be honest. That's why people went through there. But a guy, you know, guy that was well known for being extremely fair on his payoffs. And Buddy ended up homesteading out there, basically, except for the aforementioned run in the WWF. But it's out there on YouTube. I know I've got some DVDs that I just got that I want to listen to this in addition to the stuff I've already seen. Find Buddy Rose in the early 80s out in Portland, and he is just absolute solid gold. This was before Buddy became, you know, really, really heavy in the AWA and past that, when he's still, you know, he's a little bit overweight, but he's like a guy that he, it's not like you say, hey, fat boy, you know, he's a guy that's got a little bit of a, you know, the Dunlop syndrome, you know, but he's still in amazing shape and, you know, was going out there and working, you know, long matches and had the stamina to do that. But a tremendous, tremendous talent. Barry.
He doesn't get enough credit either, and you're 100% right. And Buddy was one of these guys, so if you try to put your finger on why his promo work was so good, I don't know if you can explain it. When we're sitting here and we're trying to talk about certain people and you can explain and you can't explain, I can't tell you why Buddy was so good, but he was. And I would say one thing. He did inject a little bit of humor a lot of times in his interviews, which I liked, but I don't know whether it was his delivery. I don't know what it was, but you're 100% right. And anytime Buddy, even in the AWA, when Buddy was doing promos, they were excellent. He was great. Yeah. You know, Doug Summers really wasn't a promo guy, but Buddy was. So yeah, it's an excellent choice also.
So yeah, so we'll leave it out there on the Facebook page, Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry, and give us your choice. Don't tell us Jim Cornette or The Rock or something. Of course, those guys are great. Tell me somebody who's underrated that people don't really right off the top of their head say, yeah, boy, that guy is really good. So give us your choices on our Facebook page. So now as we're wrapping up, real quick, Barry, I think you have a special announcement for any of those people that might be considering going to the Fan Fest in Lutz, Florida, or Lutz. I'm going to get that right one of these days. So on June 2nd, Barry, tell us our most recent announcement. Who's going to be there?
Absolutely. So just signed over the last couple of days, former Championship Wrestling from Florida and ECW and WCW referee Bill Fonzie Alfonso will be joining us. So joining now with Bill Alfonso, Steve Kern, Bob Root, Dory Funk Jr., Buddy Colt, more names to be announced soon. June the 2nd in the Tampa suburb of Lutz or Lutz, Florida, taking place all day at the Residence Inn Tampa Suncoast Parkway at North Point Village. Tickets to accommodate any of your price points. You can come in as low as $10 for general admission, but as far as autographs and getting photos from all of the legends, tickets start at $50. We're also going to be doing Coffee with Dory, which is limited to only 25 fans. Get to sit with the former NWA World's Heavyweight Champion for an hour and discuss his career, talk to him about anything that he wants. And then we have our special two-hour Q&A dinner, the Q&A moderated by Jim the Booker Baldrin. By you, sir. You'll be the man doing it. By special request, Bob Roop has requested, I need Jeff Baldrin there to moderate this Q&A to make sure that everything goes down correctly. So the contracts have been signed. You will be there. We're still working on getting the raise from Dave Penzer, which we're hoping comes through soon. But you can find us at eventbrite.com. Look under CWF Legends Fan Fest. We're also on Facebook, CWF Legends Fan Fest, or the Championship Wrestling from Florida Archives. Join us June the 2nd. We are also going to be doing a dinner on June the 1st, which will be Friday night for the listeners.
Woohoo!
Yes, sir. Breaking Kayfabe with Baldrin and Barry. More information coming soon, but if you are in and around the Tampa area, no ticket required for this dinner. We just hope that you'll join us and show up.
Absolutely. Quick shout out to my friends at Wrestling Mags on Instagram. They post a lot of different magazine covers. Good stuff here. Folks, you can follow me at Baldrin Jeff on Twitter. Breaking Kayfabe is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Thank you, great Brian Last. And until next week, we will see you for episode 23. Episode 23, it's a Michael Jordan episode, Barry. And we'll see you next week, folks.